Okay. Let the record show that the House Transportation Committee of March 11th, 2010 started at about 1:34. Those present were Representative Munoz, Representative Wilson, Tammy Wilson, Representative Gruenberg, and Representative Peggy Wilson. And House Recording Secretary is Nancy Hemingway. Luke is our LIO monitor back there, and Becky is my staff for the committee. So before we start, please turn off your cell phones, not just to vibrate, but all the way off if you don't mind. It does interfere with our phones or our microphones. And we'll be hearing three bills today, House Bill 354, 366, and 267. So the first one we'll start out with is House Bill 354, the Alaska Capstone Avionics Revolving Loan Fund. And then Representative Peterson has just joined us. And will the sponsors come forward and introduce your bill? State your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Matt Johnson, staff for Representative Keller. Unfortunately, he is not going to be with us today. I apologize. I want to thank the chair for giving us a hearing today. And I don't know how in-depth you would like me to go in this. I mean, I think most of you have voted on this already, probably, this program. Do you want me to talk about the program a little bit or just go into the change?
Well, I think that you probably, not everyone has heard. And so
we do have three new legislators here. Okay.
So just do a little bit of explain exactly what we did earlier on and the reasons that we're having this bill.
Sure. In 2008, the legislature created the Capstone Avionics Revolving Loan Fund and the Capstone Avionics Loan Program at the request of Governor Palin. It was based on a FAA pilot program that was conducted in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and the results were very favorable. They put the new avionics equipment there. It's both ground-based and they install it in the planes as well. They found that it reduced fatal accidents rates by 47% and reduced accidents by 47% and fatalities by a third. And the FAA projects that when this is fully implemented, that it will reduce fatal accidents by 33%. So it's a big public safety issue. The problem comes with the loan program was only opened up to owners of aircraft. And what happened with that was we have some significant in-state carriers who transport people in and out of rural Alaska who choose to lease their fleet rather than purchase their fleet. It makes more economic sense for them. But they do almost all of their flying in Alaska. And so they ask us to propose a change here to open the loan program up to lessees as well as owners. And that's what we're attempting to do here. And the Department of Commerce assures us that there will be a zero fiscal note here. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Matt, so the Capstone Avionics is something that you put in the plane where you can actually see where to go and you see the actual where the mountainsides are and all that, so that really helps the pilots. Am I correct?
Correct, and it also allows you to see where other aircraft are relative to yours. I'm not an expert on the equipment itself, but we have a couple people here from the Department of Commerce, Greg Winninger and Kathy Jeans. I don't know I know they deal with the loan side of things, and I don't know how much they deal with the actual equipment. But it is a kind of a system where it allows there to be better communication between the ground and the air and airplanes within the air, and helps them to keep track of where they're at, the terrain. It's satellite based, I believe. And so, if you have further questions, Monty Gates may be on the air online as well. I don't know if he is or not.
He
is a pilot for Penn Air.
Okay. All right. I don't have that right now, but maybe later I might be able to get it. I don't have anything.
Okay.
Representative Grunberg, you had a question?
Yes, I do. I'd like the folks from the department to come up, please. While they're walking up, I'll wait till they identify themselves. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Greg Winninger, Director of the Division of Investments.
Kathy Jean, Systems Branch Manager with Division of Investments.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Winninger or Ms. Jeans, as you prefer. The sponsor statement says, because the threshold for eligibility is predicated upon ownership of the aircraft, an owner or carrier that chooses to lease its aircraft or fleet is deemed ineligible to access the program. I don't understand this. Are you saying that if I own a plane and I lease it to somebody else, I can't participate in the program? Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. No, basically what it says is that if you lease the airplane, I couldn't make you the loan for the equipment.
Does it say that? May I follow up, please?
Follow up.
Does it say this in the statute or what?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. Yes, it does, because it says we can only make loans to owners right now.
But wouldn't you be making the loan to me? I'd be the owner regardless of who I lease it to. I'm still the owner.
Representative Grunberg, what has happened is that there are people that just buy the planes. That's their business, so they can lease them to other people, but they're not willing to put this stuff in it. So, but the people that are leasing the planes say, this is safety. This is going to help us. And so I want to be able to get the loan so that I can put it in the plane that I'm leasing.
I understand what you're saying. Is that what you're saying? That because there's a difference between what the chairman said and what you said. She said they could do it, but they're not willing to do it. You're saying under the law they can't do it. And
no.
I don't read this subsection.
Representative Grunberg, there's a big difference. I did not say that, what you just said.
Oh.
I said the owners of the plane just don't want to get the loans. That's an expense they don't want to deal with.
Oh, that's what I thought you said.
Yes. But, so set them aside. But the people that are leasing the planes want that information in there, so they want to be able to get the loan.
I understood that. The question I had was, is there anything in the law that would prevent an owner who leases the plane? Because I don't see that in this statute.
Yeah. Madam Chair, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that's correct. And we can make a loan to an owner. What this is trying to do is we have lessees that want to borrow the money instead of the owner. And by making this statutory change, that will allow us to make a loan either to an owner or to a lessee.
Through the chair, that's what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah,
so it's because the owners are unwilling to take out the loan. That's the problem here.
That's through the chair, that's correct.
May I follow up, please?
Representative Grunberg.
That being the case, do you require that the loans be collateralized by the airplane itself?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, we will require collateral. They still will need to meet all the same requirements. We do take a lien against the aircraft. The problem is that, you know, we may need to take some sort of other collateral as well, because all we really have then is the equipment in the airplane.
You see, Madam Chair, what I'm concerned about is if the owner of the plane won't take out the loan, it's likely they won't permit the loan to be collateralized by the aircraft either.
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Grunberg, but what we will do is take other collateral. If they don't have some way to collateralize the loan, we would not make the loan. This just gives us the legal authority. For example, we have a commercial carrier that has a hangar free and clear. They lease an aircraft from a company in Sweden, for example, and it's a long-term lease. They want to equip the airplane. They're offering us a deed of trust on the hangar to secure the loan. that's what would be allowed if this legislation.
If I may follow up, please.
Follow up, Representative Gruenberg.
Would you allow a lease, a long-term lease, to serve as collateral, a lease of the aircraft itself? If permitted by the lease.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I kind of doubt that we would do that, because for us to step into that position, that would just give us the ability to step in, and we don't have the expertise or training or.
And a final question, if I may. Do these lessees, the operators, I'll call them, rather than the lessees, there's the owner of the craft and then the operator of the craft. In all cases, do they have the ability I assume you require these all to be collateralized.
Through the chair, that's correct. We will, yes.
Do they all have, as far as you know, do they all have the ability to collateralize it with something else?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I'm not sure, because I don't know what the total universe is out there. We've had some that have talked to us that are interested in this piece of legislation. It's kind of where it started. In those particular cases, they do, but there may be others out there that don't. I don't know the answer to that.
I'm sorry, one more question.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the value of most of these loans?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the average loan right now is around $87,000 for the whole.
Oh, it's not cheap.
It can vary greatly between whether it's a commercial aircraft or general aviation. The general aviation are generally much less expensive, because mm-hmm. you don't have the duplication you need to have in a commercial aircraft. So on the GA side, general aviation side, you're talking more around the $12,000 to $15,000 area.
I see. But in these, you're really talking about 87. And
yes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. That really clarifies this for me,
okay.
What's going on.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just sort of one more question to sort of follow along the lines of what the representative was just talking about. So you've got between $12,000 and $100,000 to retro, and this is for retrofitting, or this is to put on new planes, or for either?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, yeah, basically this is adding this to an existing aircraft. It's an avionics suite of equipment that you would add to the aircraft, to the cockpit of the aircraft.
One follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Peterson.
So new aircraft already have this, for the most part, already have these pieces of equipment on them then?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, I would say the answer to that is probably no. This is a new technology that's being actually tried out in Alaska. It's going to actually be technology that's going to be used all over the lower 48. FAA is implementing this at airports everywhere. So I think as time goes by, that probably will be the case. Just for clarification with the committee, there is the FAA is working on some regulations right now that we think is going to involve additional manufacturers entering the picture. Those regs are scheduled to be implemented in April. And so at that time, we think the price of this equipment will also come down somewhat. And so I think in the future, yeah, it will be standard equipment in an airplane. But right now, I don't believe it is for the most part.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're sort of testing this equipment, and if it works in Alaska, it'll probably work anywhere. Is that kind of what it looks like?
Through the chair, Representative Pearson, yeah, it's been tested for the last, it was at least 6 years ago when the test started, and as a result of that, they've decided this is the way to go. And so this is technology that's going to be implemented all over the country over the next, say, 10 or 12 years.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I have a question. The FFA, are they going to, or FAA, whatever it is, are they going to provide some of the funding, or is this just?
That's a good question, Madam Chair. Actually, the FAA is providing a huge amount of money to this effort, and essentially where their participation is in all the ground infrastructure is all being done by the FAA. And I don't have the exact numbers, but it's large, a very large capital investment on the part of FAA. And what's been happening is they're kind of building out portions of the state. And part of the thinking on this loan program was they wanted to see the state of Alaska kind of step up and participate, because they're actually spending a lot of time and money on the infrastructure. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense if you don't have airplanes that are equipped to actually take advantage of the technology. And so they started the build out. They've done some Southeast Alaska's pretty much completed. They've done the Anchorage Fairbanks corridor. And they have a complete plan in place to continue the build-out throughout the rest of the state.
Okay, thank you. And my able aide has reminded me that I neglected to let everyone know that Johansson and Representative Johnson both have joined us quite some time ago. So Representative Munoz.
Thank you. What is the size of the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, it's about right now, it started out at $4.8 million was the appropriation. I believe we've got about $4.3 million in the fund at this time.
Okay.
So. And if I can, follow up?
Are those federal or state funds? You said that there is a lot of FAA involvement. I'm just curious what percentage of state involvement
sure.
we have.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, this is all state funds that was put into a revolving fund.
Okay.
So the 4.8, or it's actually down to about 4.3 that's cash available to loan. That is all state funds in the revolving fund. All of the infrastructure build out, which is completely separate, is FAA funds. I don't have the number right in front of me, but it's in the 50 to 100, it'll be in the $50 to $100 million range when they're done.
Okay.
So that's a much larger contribution, or yeah, I guess contribution.
And the follow-up Representative
Munoz. And the $50 to $100 million would be available just for Alaska?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize if you've covered this. Does the loan cover the installation, and does it take an AP mechanic, or does it typical sign-off? So can you finance the installation, or do you just finance the hardware?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes, we can also finance the installation. And you do have to be a certified installer to put this equipment in, but that is can be a part of the loan.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
And so I guess the point of collateralization is you can't collateralize that installation. So you have to have something there, the airplane or some other type of collateral. So
that's correct, Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This looks like a good piece of legislation. In fact, I just wanted to say that the language on lines 8 to 10 is much superior to the general definition of person in Title I, sufficiently that I've made a note that we should take a look at this bill as the model for updating the general definition of person and modernizing that. And I'm saying this to my friends on the State Affairs Committee, that this is a really good mm-hmm. definition of person, and I thank you. Whoever drafted it did a really good job.
Thank you.
I just had to reread that.
Did you do that?
No, but I just wanted to read what you said, because I know we've had a question on
yeah,
State Affairs.
It comes up
Affairs,
all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. And, with joint ventures and LLCs and stuff.
We don't. Is there anyone online that wants to testify? No one online. And Kathy, did you want to have anything to say about this?
No, that's fine. Thank you, Madam.
Okay, I saw your name here, and then I realized that that's who was sitting right there. Okay. Then I guess we don't even have to open public testimony, and I will then do. Is there any more committee discussion? Do I hear
Mr.
a motion?
Chairman, if I could before, just
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chairman, I've been familiar with this program since its inception and was involved in the aviation industry, and I think Alaska's in the forefront in this. And I'm very proud that we're doing this, and I think the sooner we get every airplane that is wheels up, that we will start saving lives immediately. And so I wholeheartedly encourage the passage of this legislation.
Do you want to?
I will move it. Madam Chair, move House Bill number 354 with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Hearing no objection, so moved. Thank you. And we've got some paperwork to do, and we'll take a little bit of a at ease with the committee members, since we got a late start, if there was any possibility of staying. But there are two other committees that are meeting at that same time, so it doesn't look like we'll be able to go on much longer than 3 o'clock. So we'll try to move on. Our next bill is House Bill 366, Motor Carrier indemnification agreements, and that is Representative Johnson. Do you want to introduce your staff? And
Madam Chair, certainly, and I would appreciate the opportunity to present this bill. And with that, I will introduce Jeannie Osnes, who's my staff. And I'll, a little bit on the history of this. This bill came to us from industry. And this is very similar to some indemnification language that we did last year for contracts with the university and other government agencies. It has come to our attention that in the private sector, there are situations where, in some cases, large companies are forcing smaller transportation companies to take the liability and responsibility for transport of goods. And what this bill does is basically say that you are responsible for your own self and your own mistakes, and that you cannot hold someone else responsible for your mistakes and enter that into a contract. So this is a fairness. It prevents the little guy from putting his business on the line every time they roll down the road. And with that, I would turn this over to my capable staff, Jeannie Osnes.
Hey, Jeannie.
Thank you. Since this bill has been introduced, the other side got involved with the legislation as well, the other side being the shipper part. So all's fair on both sides. They agree to the bill as it is with the amendment that has been handed out. It's making Amendment R.2. It's making both
Madam Chair, I would like to move amendment number 1, which is 26 LS 1434 R/R.2.
Okay,
I'll object for discussion.
Okay, we now have the amendment before, so you can speak to the amendment.
Thank you. So since the motor carrier and the shippers have now been involved in it, it's kind of a win-win situation for both sides. They're both agreeing that the agreement that goes between the shipping and the motor carrier, that they will indemnify, defend, and hold each other harmless to their own problems that they have with whatever happens during the transport of the goods.
Now, can you give us an example?
Maybe something like your china gets packed and it's in a box and somebody packed that for you and it has good packing around it. There's some discussion as it goes over to the carrier that's going to bring it to you. Something happens in the shipment, it gets broken. Where does the who's going to pay for that? And so that's where the agreement comes. If one didn't pack it well enough, or two, the truck rolled over, you've got the two situations that become a discussion. And since each are holding each of them harmless to what it is that happens to the shipment, it comes down to proving what happened during that shipment of the goods.
So if during this process, would it go to court? I mean, if they couldn't agree to it, this amendment now says that if it's in my possession, I'm responsible. That's the way it is?
No. I think it says that I'm responsible to a point. If I made the problem, mm-hmm. I take the heat. If someone else didn't pack it, maybe just threw it all in a box and away it goes, all of that has to be proven. I'm sure it's either gone through some discussion and or court.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, we have with us Aves Thompson with the Truckers Association, and they are actually the entity that brought this forward, and he deals with this on a daily basis, and he might be able to shed some light on some examples that would, I think, help the committee.
Okay.
And with your permission.
And we will do that. Have you finished otherwise with your introduction of the bill?
Yes, I have. Basically, the amendment now added to the bill brings both sides in and it's a win-win situation for both sides.
Okay. Why don't you then come on up and... Is it Chuck? What's your first name?
Aves.
Aves.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Aves Thompson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association. Thanks for the opportunity to appear for you today. I'd like to go directly to the example question first, if I may. A good example would be a motor carrier contract where a motor carrier has agreed to transport fuel from a company to another place. If the the fuel truck pulls into the loading rack and if the shipper's employee turns the wrong valve and spills the fuel, the shipper then is responsible. In some cases, contracts are being written that would indemnify the shipper against that and provide that the carrier would pay for that, those damages. Another example might be where you ship a piece of equipment that needs to be offloaded from a flatbed trailer by a forklift. So the carrier pulls into the shipper's yard, and the shipper uses their employee and their forklift to offload this piece of equipment, and the employee mishandles it and breaks the freight. So under certain circumstances currently, there's contract language that would say the carrier would be responsible for that. And all what we're trying to do through this legislation is to say if you're negligent, if your actions or inactions are negligent, then you're responsible. And if it be it the motor carrier or the shipper. And we're not looking for something for nothing here, just to level the playing field.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson.
Yeah, Mr. Thompson, thanks for coming. What happens if, in your example, a truck comes in and the warehouse employee hops on the forklift, the other party, two parties, the truck party and the warehouse party, if I'm following kind of your example, the warehouseman comes out and pulls a pallet off the truck, and the pallet tips over and something breaks. Now, the trucker says, I secured it on my truck properly. The forklift driver says, I took it off properly. You loaded it wrong. No, you took it off wrong. Where is the, who decides, as the sponsor's staff said, somehow we decide who actually is responsible. What's that process? Is it a court? Is it a board? An appeal process somewhere? How do we decide who's responsible?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, in my opinion, that would be adjudicated. It would be the insurance companies would look at the situation, the specific situation, and handle it much like they do today. We're not trying to set up some new system of assigning responsibility. But simply to make it clear that, and oftentimes, it's not solely the negligence of one party or the other. So there's still going to be that determination of liability. Well, we just want to make it clear that one party to the contract cannot demand that the other party sign away or assume some liabilities that are not theirs.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I just follow up?
Sorry,
very quickly?
I
loaded and drove many trucks and unloaded many trucks, and I never made a mistake. They were all perfectly loaded and driven.
Of course that's what it is.
Through the chair, that's what I expect, Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Good answer.
Yeah. Representative Gruenberg.
I sent a note to the sponsor of the bill. And I was just concerned a little bit, because you could have, and this looks, I guess we're, I don't know if we're on the amendment of the bill, but somewhere, you could have a third party involved. For example, let's say us sending our stuff from our home in Anchorage or Ketchikan or Wrangell or North Pole down here to Juneau, and we could take the stuff to a packaging store, the Anchorage packaging store, and then it gets put on a carrier and it comes down. And what I was wondering really would be on page 2, line 12, where it says storage of property. I think we could easily just say storage or packing of property, because really that's a third party that's often involved in these things. I'm not talking about a mover that operates the warehouse, but I'm talking about truly a third party, and if it sounds like we wish to be fair to everybody, that we shouldn't allow them to escape from their own negligence either if they don't pack the property correctly. And I'm wondering if you or anybody would have to be a simple kind of a solution just to make sure that doesn't fall between the cracks.
Okay. What I'd like to do at this point is to, unless that would be an amendment to the amendment.
I think I'd do it as a separate amendment to the bill.
So let's just kind of hold that.
Okay. It was more of a comment.
Yeah.
May I ask? Well, I won't even ask Mr. Thompson then, unless you want to speak.
Okay. So we have the bill before us. We have amendment number one before us. And so before we do anything else, would you speak, Representative Johnson, just to the amendments, and then we will deal with the amendment.
The amendment, I support the amendment, first of all. I think that the intent of this was to be fair, and I think it is fair. What we're looking at here are situations, and I'll go to an extreme, where maybe a trucking company that is a sole proprietor has one truck, and they are contracted to transport, and let's just use Alaskan term, something from the shipyard in Anchorage to Prudhoe Bay. The company that is hiring them in some instances will say, to get this job, you must take responsibility for everything. And so that one truck owner, for example, may take chances that they wouldn't take if they were a big company because they want the business. So this person is putting his truck, his company, and his familyhood and his livelihood on the line every time he takes a load with that contract. Even it may not be his fault. Now, if someone is certainly, he has to have insurance, he has to do the thing. So as a result of that, I think the individual's insurance goes up. I think the cost of shipping goods go up. And the responsibility is not where it should be. The purpose of this bill is to protect. The original purpose was to protect that transporter. Having talked to the people that are maybe doing the actual shipping, that if it is not their fault, they should not be indemnified at the expense of the others. So I think this is basically, if there is a mistake, the person making the mistake is responsible. The person's insurance company who makes the mistake is responsible. And it keeps someone from trying to shift that responsibility or that financial responsibility onto another person, and that is the intent of the legislation, to be fair, to help out. Hopefully we can take the cost of shipping down a little bit because we won't have to have those insurance policies. If you remember in the previous legislation, you couldn't even buy insurance that would indemnify you. I don't know what the trucker can do, but in many cases you can't buy insurance to indemnify another person for something that you do. So, but what this does is it gives both parties protection, and they're only responsible for their actions and not the actions of the contracting party.
So amendment number one is an agreement that came about by all the entities getting together and discussing how would be the best and the fairest way to deal with it.
Yes, ma'am. And it became, just as it was unfair to put all the burden on the transporter for it, it was unfair to not at least have the transporter to have it go the other way. So this is an attempt to basically, I think it's shared in several liability, to use the term, the official term.
Joint and several.
So that you are responsible for your actions and the person that you're contracting with is responsible for theirs.
Okay. Any other questions?
I remove my objection.
Okay. Objection being removed. I hear nothing else. So amendment number one has been passed. Any other debate? You wanted to go ahead with amendment number two.
Yeah, I was just asking if the sponsor would be willing to accept. What I would do would be page 2, line 12, between the words the and storage, I would say packing and storage. So adding packing and.
And or?
I think you would say and. That would mean if either one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
I'll object for discussion.
Madam Chair, I don't think I have a problem with that, but I'm wondering about third-party packaging stores where someone comes in and, for example, I want to ship my trophy antler back to Oklahoma. And I have a contract with that packing company to pack it in such a way, and my contract is with that person. And then that person has a contract with another company, and so I'm wondering where does it end with me because I didn't provide it to them properly? Is it the packaging store? Is it the shipping company? Is it the person on the other end who delivers it? I'm not sure how far we can go down the road on this without it. And I don't think I'm opposed to it, but I just don't think I have the answer that you may be looking for. I don't know how many people now have been involved in this.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Okay. My question is that we are talking about the transportation services here. We're not talking about the packaging services. We're talking about under four, it's transportation services. So are we getting...
May I respond to both of you?
Representative Bruenberg.
We're talking about the process here from the time the goods are loaded until they're delivered. And packing, if it's done, whoever does it is an integral part of that. And the purpose of my amendment number two, is to ensure that each party is responsible only for its own negligence and for no one else. And when you say the word including, that means including but not limited to. And I want to be sure that if a situation arises where there is an intermediate packer, that they are responsible for their share if they are negligent in whole or in part. It's what's called comparative negligence. Yeah. And they apportion it. And there may be, if you give them your antlers and they're broken or partly broken, then you would be responsible to some extent. And they would be responsible if they were negligent in their handling of it. And this is just a very clear, simple amendment to make certain that each party to the whole process is responsible for their negligence and only their negligence.
I see a gleam in someone's eye over here.
She's just excited to be here.
Would you state your name and then go on?
It's Jeannie Osnes. I'm employed by Representative Craig Johnson. And on line 12 of page 2, there is a comma after providing a service. And so packing could be that service
right.
already.
Right. I just, through the chair, Madam Chair, I want to make it simple and clear because we already say warehouses, and I want to be sure that's in there.
But I think the service would be the packing.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I don't have a problem with this. It goes to judiciary. I would like to look into it further.
Of course.
And if there's something big gleaming error, then I would certainly can work with the maker of the amendment in the next committee. So I certainly don't have a problem with it. I think it may even make it more appealing to me in terms of fairness. So I really don't have a problem with it. And if there is one, we can research it and certainly fix it in the next committee. I have no problem with that. But right now, I don't see any problem.
Madam Chair, I commit to do exactly that. And okay. You know I will.
And I will ignore, I'll remove my objection. Didn't have any comments. I looked.
Never mind.
Okay. Hearing no objection, amendment number 2 has passed. Okay. We do have someone online. We have made changes to this, but we do have someone online off net. Chuck Onsott with the Alaska Trucking Association.
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead and give us your name and affiliation and then your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Chuck Onsott. I'm the general manager of Midnight Sun Transportation. I also represent the Trucking Association as their president. I haven't seen the amendments that you're talking about, but it certainly sounds like the verbiage that has been added is certainly what we've been looking for. You know, I mean, just in a nutshell, the whole legislation is really just to help protect the small trucking companies from the larger businesses that there aren't really willing to take on their responsibilities.
Okay, thank you, Chuck. And I don't see any questions. Thank you very much. James Doyle from Anchorage.
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Jimmy Doyle. I'm the Vice President and one of the owners of Weaver Brothers Trucking. We are an Alaskan-owned trucking company with approximately 150 employees. Been in business almost 50 years. We've got terminals in Anchorage, Kenai, and Fairbanks. And we wholeheartedly support this piece of legislation. In the last 5 to 10 years, the business environment has been such that we have been asked to sign agreements by shippers where we are asked to take on not only our own liability, but theirs. We have to follow the Department of Transportation and Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations, so we, by law, have to have the required insurance to cover our negligence. And it's just not fair at all when we're being asked by the shippers to basically supply insurance for us and them. You have you've heard a couple of examples, I guess, potential examples of what could happen. I have actually a real one that did happen, not to us, but to the insurer that we use as our insurer. A trucking company, as it turns out, was delivering a load of fuel to a gas station, had delivered that load of fuel and had left and had been gone for several days, so was nowhere attached to the gas station. A customer came in, was filling up a small gas can in the back of his pickup. There was some static electricity which caused a fire, and not only was there damage to the vehicle, but obviously there was also damage to that person. The trucking company had signed one of these agreements that we have spoken about that caused that they should be liable for not only their damages but any others. And the trucking company, although they were nowhere around in this example, they were held liable through a contract they had signed for the damages to that person, which was close to $1 million. So that's a real life scenario, what can happen in one of these things. And this piece of legislation will just simply make things right so that each party takes care of their own liability.
So it sounds like this bill would make life a little bit better for you guys out there.
Yes, it would make it a lot fairer, and I urge the committee to vote yes on this bill.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Is there anyone else online that would like to testify? Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? Then I'm going to close testimony, public testimony, and committee, how do you feel about this bill?
Madam Chair, I had a question for
the sponsor. Representative Johansson has a question for the sponsor.
Probably Jeannie. you mentioned in your opening that the original bill as introduced, you characterize it as the other side had problems with it, and we've had testimony from the truckers. Who is the other side, and why aren't they here, and do the truckers feel, I mean, who are we talking about, I guess?
The genesis of the bill did come from the motor carriers, so the letters of support and things of that nature have been coming in. I would say within the last 2 days, the shippers came on board discussing this with Mr. Thompson. I think we have large oil companies that are involved in this. When I started this, I called DOT. They had helped us with an indemnification bill earlier. This isn't part of what they deal with at all, but they did indicate some of the larger oil companies were involved with this, and I'm sure the people who are doing the actual trucking would have other people that have been involved with it, but they have been involved and have worked with the language. So British Petroleum was one that looked at the language and brought in their side and have agreed with it.
Just follow up.
Follow up, Representative Johansson.
So would it be fair to say that the truckers were working with the shippers and brought the amendment that we just adopted to the table, and so kind of abstractly through the truckers, the problems from the shippers have been taken care of?
Yes.
So, okay.
Madam Chairman, if I might, I think someone would have a problem with this bill was that gas station owner that didn't have to pay the $1 million. I think they delight in having someone else be responsible for their mistake. So I think anyone and probably a room full of attorneys who always try to protect their clients to the utmost would also have, no offense, Representative Grimberg.
I was going to say I got to oppose the bill now.
But it you know, it's kind of like, you know, take your own responsibility, and that might take some lawyers out of the courtroom, and for my money that may not be bad, but I may have just lost a vote.
No,
you did. thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Tammy Wilson.
Well, if there's no other questions, can we move the bill?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to move House Bill number 366 /R as amended.
Individual recommendations.
With individual recommendations.
Okay. And
zero fiscal note.
Okay.
Thank you.
I hear no objections, so moved.
Thank you for hearing the bill.
And we'll take a little bit of a recess. On for business here, Representative Kelly, would you introduce yourself and your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Kelly. I'm a representative from District 7, Fairbanks, and before you today to talk to you about House Bill 267, which is the Dalton Highway Access Bill.
And actually, it is version R that we're going to have before us. So,
okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Glad you spoke there. I'm getting my breath from running down from the other committee we were before, and I guess we traded Representative Gruenberg for Kelly.
I'm anyway, sure who got the best end of that deal?
Is there a player to be named later?
Player to be named later.
Knew that was coming. Since 1980, state law has prohibited virtually all off-road vehicle use within 5 miles on each side of the Dalton Highway north of the Yukon River. There are exceptions for miners and oil workers and a few folks who live in the corridor, but otherwise it is strictly prohibited. HB 267 simply ends that long-standing prohibition on Alaskans' right to travel by snow machine on this public corridor north of the Yukon. Now, many Alaskans believe that the current prohibition is the feds, that they're doing it. Wrong. The problem is the state. And the feds are quick to point that out when people complain to them along the corridor that there was an original prohibition, may have made sense when that was an oil service road in the beginning, but does not make sense now to have a fence running hundreds of miles between the Yukon and the Arctic Ocean. So it's a problem that the news miner in an excerpt from their editorial said the blanket prohibition north of the Yukon is overkill. And we believe it's overkill, and we believe that it's time to end that. And HB 267 will allow snow machine use on the Dalton Highway corridor from October 1 to October 30, when the ground is frozen, snow covered, and the resulting impact on surface vegetation would be minimal. As you know, snow machines are allowed to operate all over Alaska, and we have decades of use that demonstrates that the damage is minimal, if any. I'd like to point out, Madam Chair, that if 267 passes, the prohibition on other off-road vehicles will remain. This applies strictly to snow machines. And I'd like to point out that relative to hunting, that is strictly controlled. The methods, means are strictly controlled by fish and game laws, regulations. And so this does not change anything to do with that either. So some of the concerns would be naturally in those areas, damage to the terrain, and what's that going to do to my rights to hunt and fish. So this is strictly eliminating the prohibition on access, nothing more. And with that, since you're in a hurry, Madam Chair, I will dog it off.
Okay, and I believe, or at least I thought I heard you say from October 1st to October 30th, but you meant till April 30th?
April 30th. Okay. If I said October, it's October 1st to April 30th.
Okay, and then during this time, would the hunting seasons, do they say certain vehicles have to stop during hunting season or anything? Do you know?
There are regulations which prevent using vehicles for transporting relative to hunting within the corridor. This would not change those. So those would remain in place, which is typical all over Alaska. The methods, means, and bag limits and that sort of thing, and season lengths are strictly regulated in other sections of the law.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Kelly, if there was an extremely late snow year and someone wanted to, and it was, you know, the middle of October, would there be any way to stop people from operating their snow machine on the non-snow-covered ground?
I would imagine that they could do something like that, an emergency closure. However, I would point out on all the roads in Alaska, the same challenge applies. And so that I'm a rider, and I don't ride when there isn't snow. It's absolutely miserable, burns up the track, and so it's just so difficult that you just don't find many people, maybe a knothead or two here and there, that want to ride in those conditions. But if in fact it was as you say, I would imagine there could be some sort of an emergency closure. But I think this period that we've named north of the Yukon is pretty generally chilly time and snow cover time. Right. Through the chair.
All right, well, we have lots of people that want to testify.
I knew that.
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Could you explain, it says it's prohibited, does not apply to the use of a snow machine to travel across the highway between these periods. Is the area outside of 5 miles open for snow machines?
Yes, Matt, through the chair. You can travel from, let's just say that you have a snow machine and you're located west of the corridor. As long as you're going to go across it to the east and that you're traveling, that is permitted. It's travel within the corridor that begins from the road and goes either east or west of the road that is now prohibited.
And Madam Chair, if I could, just for clarification.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
So this would allow you to pull up off the side of the road, unload your snow machine, and have access to the property outside of that 5 miles, and including that 5 miles on either side. Is that what this does?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Johnson.
So, and I just so so right now, how many miles of road are we talking about that is involved right now?
Let's see, from the Yukon, Madam Chair, from the Yukon to the North Slope or to the Arctic, to the ocean, is, I'm going to guess, close to 300 miles, 357.
Okay, so 357 miles. So right now, they can't do it from the Yukon North.
Madam Chair, correct.
And there's a buffer zone of 5 miles on each side of the highway.
Correct.
And you're just wanting to get rid of that totally, except during the summer.
Correct. This would make it like the other roads in Alaska, essentially, and not lock us off of access to the land for that the 5 miles on either side. That's now a no zone.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. How do you get to the land outside of that 5 miles? I mean, are we basically, by having this 10-mile swath, are we saying there's basically, if you don't fly it in or some other way, you just don't get a snow machine, or you have to enter from the top or the bottom? So we're excluding that, 6,000 square miles of...
Madam Chair, if you're not fortunate enough to fly or you're not healthy enough to hike,
That's exactly the case.
Madam Chair, if I
follow up, Representative Johnson.
So other than flying and hiking, this land outside of that 10-mile corridor is shut off.
Through the chair, that's the way I see it.
I just want to make sure I was thinking in the right vein.
Well,
thank you.
But now I do want to. I'm looking at the bill itself, and it does say that there were some exceptions, and the exceptions were use of off-road vehicles necessary for oil and gas exploration, development, production, and transportation. A person who holds mining claim activity on the highway, he must use land for right-of-way, blah, blah, blah. And the use of snow machines to travel across the highway. So, I mean, there was, you know, for people that owned it and right. or that had reason for their work or whatever, yes. there was access.
Right. And Madam Chair, I appreciate that. And what I was looking at more is people putting meat on the table for the purposes of hunting and recreation, probably less because that's quite a distance to travel. But this excludes someone from basically taking a snow machine, going out and hunting because that's not included in those exemptions. Yeah. So I'm looking at
but
more.
But they could walk in and get
They could walk in the 5 miles, yes, ma'am. And that, have you ever seen that part of the country?
Yes,
I know you have. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. It's clear in my head now. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for anyone? Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, if I could clarify one point. The mention of being able to go back in and hunt if this passes would not be correct. Unrestricted, because the currently, for purposes of hunting, it is limited and would stay so. And so that relates to the means and methods and bag limits that would be under the control of the Fish and Game. So this does not change that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, is any of this land, the 357 miles, does it cross parkland? Is it a state park, federal parkland, wildlife refuge, or none of the above?
Madam Chair, none of the above.
None of the above.
It's state land.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get to Representative Mark Newman has joined us. Thank you for being here. Would you like to come forward?
You done with me?
Yeah, I think so. For the time being.
I don't think so. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mark Newman, District 15, and co-prime sponsor of the bill. And, you know, members, when I looked at doing this and working on it, you know, this, as Representative Johnson has stated earlier, it's a game management tool. Right now, it's my understanding we've got, a way over abundance of population of caribou up in that area, reaching 80,000, 80,000 animals, where optimum is around 37.5.
Well, excuse me, but whenever we hear about ANWR and everything, that's not what we hear.
Yeah, it's kind of like that picture behind you, Madam Chair.
Sorry, I had to put that in there. Okay.
Yeah, and so, you know, realizing that what food, you know, lichen is a primary food source of caribou. Lichen can take 50 years to grow 2.5 inches, 3 inches. And so trying to manage this herd is absolutely critical to the Board of Game to be able to provide access to Alaskans to be able to feed their families. Ultimately, we should be harvesting between 3,000 and 3,500 animals a year out of this herd. And we're doing less than 800, you know, between 700 and 800. And so what we've got is a herd that is increasing in numbers that is providing a tremendous amount of concern for overgrazing, and which will cause this herd to crash. And we've seen that in several areas of the state. And when they crash hard and they crash fast, and they don't come back very fast. And that's the problem. And I see this, you know, my whole goal on this was to use it as a management tool, the ability to put more meat in Alaska's freezers. And when we look at the Nelchina caribou herd, which has come under intense pressure, changed from tier two to a tier one level for management harvested or harvest management purposes, because there's so many people who want to apply for that permit to get into that to be able to harvest an animal for their families, they can't. And so this is another 3,000 animals a year that we could be using to feed Alaskans, and that's a good thing.
Excuse me, because I missed something somewhere. I thought that this wasn't going to make any changes on any kind of hunting.
Well, Madam Chair, it can be changed. It'll be the division of, or not the division, but the Board of Game would have the opportunity to be able to provide for management of this herd in a better way.
Oh, so... the Board of Game, because it's in state law, they can't do what they want to do, so this is for the Board of Game so that they can make management of make decisions in a different way?
That's the way I understand it. You know, Madam Chair, you're certainly familiar with the Board of Fish. You know, which deals with the fisheries, and we have the Board of Game, which deals with wildlife conservation and animals.
Okay.
And how those are allocated and managed throughout the state. And but they do receive advice from the department in the management of animals.
The board. So, okay. Thank you.
And so, again, you know, just trying to make sure that we have long-term sustainable food products for Alaskans. You know, I mean, there is a lot of people who depend on these animals, you know, to feed their families currently. But if this herd crashes, like we've seen in southwestern Alaska, and for the folks who've been over there flying around looking at where Pebble might be in that area, you know, I've flown over there several times. I've never seen a caribou yet, and there used to be, you know, hundreds of thousands of caribou in that area, and because they crash so hard, and because of, you know, wolves and predation, but particularly in an area in the Arctic like that where, again, you have such slow growth of the ability to have the lichens as their main food source and things like that, being able to allow access for Alaskans to be able to go in there and help the Department of the Board of Game and the department manage this herd for abundance for Alaskans as required in statute. That's my goal in this, and try and make sure that happens.
All right.
And to have a sustained long-term herd for the rest of Alaskans for a long time to come.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. It's obvious that we are not going to be able to get to all of the people that are online for testimony, and what we'd like to do, what I'd like to do, is I do have someone from the Division of Mining, Land, Water, and when I hear that you have a meeting, so will you be able to come back and testify at another time? Because obviously we won't be able to move this bill today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Wynn. I can come back and testify at any point in the future.
Okay, fine. Then I'm going to kind of... is there anyone here in the room that wants to testify but will not be able to come back at the next time we take this bill up? Okay.
Madam Chair, I can testify now, depending on... I mean, it'd be easier for me to testify now because I'm not sure if I'll be available.
Okay, well, why don't you come forward and state your name and and your affiliation.
Madam Chair, my name's Thor Stacy, and I just recently moved to Juneau to go to school here full-time. In the past 7 years, I've been living within the region in question, Wiseman Village. I'm here to speak to the committee specifically on issues in regards to transportation on this bill. I have I'm a registered hunting guide here in Alaska. I have permits in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and within the Canoe National Wildlife Refuge. My family has significant mining interests in the region in question. I personally traveled the road, I would say, hundreds of times, but well over 100 times in the winter and in the summer. I remember when it was closed to the general public, for instance. I'll state that I'm in opposition of this bill and that I have a couple recommendations or some requests, I guess, for the committee. And the first thing I want to highlight is the intent of this road is a support for the state's money, which is Prudhoe Bay. as it stands right now, 100% of the overland transport to Prudhoe Bay and the oil fields that run our state goes over this road. All the infrastructure that's in place at this moment is designed to support this transportation. All the pullouts on the road are set up for truckers to either sleep overnight and take a rest or to chain their vehicles up. During the time that this bill is proposed, you know, the winter transportation is also the only time that heavy loads, that's drill pipe, huge ATCOs, loads that are over a certain weight limit are allowed to be transported on the Dalton Highway because of the frozen condition of the road. Much of the road is still gravel. By allowing a recreational use at this time, or an additional recreational use at this time, we're putting a recreational use in direct competition or overlay with our industrial infrastructure. What we have right now is we have truckers that have to haul loads during this time. We have a future project in the area, which is the gas pipeline. It will demand additional infrastructure. All the recreational pullouts in use in the region are only open during the summer and not maintained during the winter. Additionally, due to funding, we have low infrastructure as far as wildlife troopers, or at this point, almost, I don't know of any state highway enforcement on the road. We don't have medical emergency services in the area. The only medical emergency services provided or can be provided if there's an accident or a severe problem in this extreme difficult part of the state to travel in would be potentially provided by Alyeska Pipeline Services because they have EMTs at the pump station. That is not the intent of their private medical force. There's no way to handle, I mean, I've gone over Attigan Pass, Beaver Slide in the middle of the winter, and a ground blizzard, been sandwiched between trucks. There's no way to handle an accident or a condition in an expedient manner. If you have a wreck, you got trucks pulling trailers with snow machines on them, you know, what happens to the family that goes out hunting at this time? Is the state providing a level of public safety that's appropriate? Does it have the capacity to do so? The answer is it can if it provides money. There's no fiscal note attached to this bill. There's no discussion of what it's going to be required to. I mean, where are these guys going to park? They're going to park where trucks are chaining up. They're going to park on access roads going to the pipeline. You can't block those access roads because they have to do regular inspections of the pipe to make sure there's no problems with oil or whatever. I mean, that's part of Alyeska's charter. Those places are plowed at their own expense, sometimes with cooperation with the state in small matters, depending on the conditions. But they are not for recreational pullouts or parking. So I would request with this committee to make a better liaison with industrial concerns in the area. I worked at a mine in Nolan Creek. We had to haul heavy equipment up in the winter. I worked under, you know, that at that time of year, because of the environment, that's when the industry has to happen as well. It's the most critical time for transportation services to supply the environment. This recreational use will overlay and compete and potentially inhibit the state's vital industry. So I would specifically request that at this time with future gas development, the future gas line coming up, without infrastructure in place and without a clear understanding of what exactly would need to happen, that this bill doesn't get moved, and that there's a better liaison with industrial concerns and definitely a fiscal note, because the obligation to the state, the people, myself traveling the road, it is publicly maintained. We should feel that there's infrastructure or support the state's obligation to provide public safety on a public maintained highway.
Okay, any questions? Thank you, Thor, very much.
Thank you.
Let's get some, we've got some people up in Barrow. Jeff Carroll.
Yes. Hello, Madam Chairman, members of the Transportation Committee. My name is Jeff Carroll. I've been a wildlife biologist on the North Slope for 30 years. I'll present my own personal opinion. I what I say does not represent an official position of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game on this bill. I'd like to speak in opposition to House Bill 267. One very important reason not to pass HB 267 is what it does to the state's credibility. When decisions were being made as to whether the Hall Road would be built or not, North Slope people were assured that the road would not be open to the public. Then the road was open to the public. Another promise was that wildlife resources and the land would be protected by not allowing people to use off-road vehicles to access the land surrounding the Hall Road. Now that the threat of that promise being broken, too. If the state wants to have credibility on the North Slope, then the legislature should not pass HB 267. Another reason not to open the corridor, the use of snow machines, is that it would result in user conflicts with local hunters. There was talk earlier about the Central Arctic Herd. I'll just say quickly that there were statements made that were, you know, very overblown. The Central Arctic Herd number is about 65,000. There's absolutely no evidence that it's anywhere near overgrazing its range. There's a lot of range for it to expand to. But I'd like to speak about the Teshipuk caribou herd, which numbers about 62,000, and it's a very important subsistence resource on the North Slope. Most of the range of the Teshipuk herd is in the central and western North Slope, but between 2002 and 2008, a substantial portion of the herd wintered in the area surrounding the Dalton Highway. Recently, the Board of Game increased the bag limit for caribou in that area from 2 to 5 caribou. If HB 267 is passed and the Board of Game allows hunters to use snow machines to hunt in that area, the harvest of Teshikfuk caribou in that area would increase substantially. The harvest rate on that herd is high enough that if harvest increased near the Dalton Highway, we would have a decreased harvest somewhere else. It would create a major user conflict situation pitting people hunting off the Dalton Highway against North Slope subsistence hunters. Even if there is no increase in hunting, increased snow machine activity in the corridor would impact wildlife. Part of the strategy of Arctic animals for surviving in the winter is to become somewhat sedentary and conserve energy. With increased activity, animals use up their energy reserves and often starve before winter is over. Musk oxen are particularly vulnerable to this. When people see musk oxen in the corridor, it is inevitable that they will drive up for a closer look, which will result in musk oxen moving and using up energy reserves. It will also result in scattering of bunches, making them more vulnerable to predation and abandonment of calves. Musk ox numbers on the North Slope have seriously declined in recent years. The last thing this depleted population needs is harassment, particularly during winter months when they're supposed to be sedentary. In summary, in order to maintain its credibility, the state should honor its promise to limit access to North Slope lands and minimize impacts on subsistence hunters, the wildlife, and the land by voting down HB 267. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. We'll go on to Todd Clark in Anchorage.
Yes, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank Representatives Kelly and Newman for bringing this bill forward. I'm speaking in support of the bill. My name is Todd Clark, and I'm in Anchorage. First of all, I want to point out that the state constitution under Section 2, Natural Resources, among other things, allows us to provide for the development of land and waters for the maximum benefit of the people. And I think you have to look at that area up there and take a look at, the, as Representative Kelly pointed out, how this corridor acts as a fence and the general user doesn't get access into the millions of acres that are beyond that. I think you have to look at the 20-year picture for the entire state. You have to figure that 20 years from now, probably twice as many people are going to be trying to access the state's resources. And our current mode in managing those resources seems to be to restrict more. I think this is an opportunity to create more access to the state's resources with very minimal impact. Snowmobiles are even, for the most part, allowed of lands that are managed by state parks with sufficient snow coverage. So I think the impact is pretty minimal. State Park seems to agree with that. Right now, those lands and resources are available to pilots. They're available to mining and other commerce, and they're available to people who live in that corridor. But they're not available to the average resident. The average resident, like myself, they would just like access to those lands and those resources as well. If you haven't driven that highway, you should sometime. It's amazing. You can drive for a day, and you can look as far as you can east and as far as you can west, and essentially the average person can't get to that lamp. We're locked out of it. That's all I have to say, and I appreciate the time to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd. Randy Quincy, Matsu.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to testify. This is Randy Quincy. I'm representing AOC as a board member. We have 2,300 AOC members and 48 clubs with over 10,000 collective members, and we would like to say that we support House Bill number 267. Thank you.
Thank you very much. How about Jack Rakoff?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, sorry. I was on monitor. I'm not in support of House Bill 267. The Board of Game has written a letter in November of 2009 in support of even the pre-bill in its meeting in Nome. So it's a given that there will be hunting pressure exerted against the resources near the Dalton Highway with snow machines in winter. Senate Bill 85 was a very similar bill, and it was there was a Senate Resource Committee that went through Fairbanks, Wiseman, Barrow. Everybody was very concerned about the increased activities and a lot of what Geoff Carroll was talking about, disturbing the animals and basically outright killing of these animals. There's been a 150% increase in bag limit as of March 1 at the latest Board of Game meeting. And bag limit, the 25% of the hunters are non-resident hunters that have been hunting from the Dalton Highway. They hunt. There's been two additional months of harvest, and there's been a 90% increase in harvest opportunity for cow caribou. I'm very concerned. I'm the chair of the Western Interior Regional Advisory Council, the co-chair of the Kuykok River Advisory Committee. The people of this area are very concerned about the additional harvest opportunity. What was submitted to the Board of Game is that the herd is imminent of crash, as some members were stating. The reality is the department did not provide any documentation that the herd is in imminence of decline. Productivity is high. Two-year-old cows, and any time a two-year-old cow has a caribou calf, then it's showing that the herd is healthy. There's no sign or imminence of decline. The Central Arctic herd is utilizing areas on the south slope of the Brooks Range that they has not been used by caribou for 35 years, so there's lots of additional resource for the caribou to use. The reality is there's 5 caribou limit allocated to non-resident hunters, and there will be a huge increase by non-Alaskans. This is supposed to be an Alaskan priority bill. No, it's not for Alaskans. This has a high non-resident usage allocated currently. There's boats, there's dog teams, there's aircraft, and what the Melchatna caribou herd had primarily aircraft access went from 200,000 animals to 28,000 animals in 12 years of an 86% decline. There was one adult bull per 100 cows in that herd, which basically they had no breeding capacity. The snow machine access is so efficient that it'll have to be eliminated in a short time, because as those cow caribou cross back over the Brooks Range and move across the coastal plain, the area that can be hunted does not even break up until mid-May. And so with year-round hunting access to cow caribou, basically until the middle of May, they will be subjected to high harvest. And so we'll have to stop the snow machine access to this caribou herd in a very short time frame. It'll be a flash in the pan. Caribou do not recover. It takes decades to recover them. The reality is the caribou cannot sustain this level of harvest that we already have in place, and snow machine access is is far above what they can sustain. Doll sheep have wintering critical habitats, high marking on the sides of the mountains, chasing doll sheep off their wintering habitats will kill the doll sheep. This is the most northerly wild sheep population in the world. And so the oil industry will be required to have additional restrictions once this herd is decimated. The oil industry has enjoyed the growing population of caribou, and it's been sort of shown as the industry can be cohabitate with the resource. The reality is, once this herd is decimated by over-harvest and encouraged with the use of snow machine access, the industry will incur much more expense for drilling and so forth in the expanded areas, and also within its current field. And so the bill is basically has so many problems with EMS and the other aspects that Thor Stacey brought out. All you have to do is watch ice road truckers to see how dangerous this road is to drive. It has steep hills and inclines. Pickups and vehicles with heavy trailers pulling snow machines up this road are inevitable to jackknife in the middle of the road. We're going to have accidents. There will need to be a large fiscal note attached to this bill for EMS, additional troopers. Right now, I was down here at the trooper's office. The trooper that at Coldfoot has not been present since the end of September. This is a 78,000 square mile coverage area for the Alaska State Troopers. There is no trooper here right now. So there's going to have to be additional funding for troopers, a medevac helicopter. The bottom line is this bill has many flaws. These were promises made to protect the resources. The wheel is not broken currently. The game resources are completely compatible with the industrial traffic and the hunting pressure that's put against the herd. Currently, it's not 800 caribou harvest. When we actually got incorporated all the village harvest of the Central Brooks Range, it was actually 2,000 caribou were approximately harvest. We only need 1,350 more caribou to harvest to meet sustainability. And the reality is we're going to attract, with 5 caribou limit, hundreds of additional non-residents and resident hunters, and the air taxis that will support their access into the north slope of the Brooks Range. The reality is this bill would have huge detrimental effects to the caribou herds, and the managers and the people of Alaska will be looked at as slaughterers of the resource that inhabits the Arctic coastal plain, which is under high spotlight. And so I urge you not to adopt this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. And where are you from?
I live in Wiseman, Alaska, right halfway between Fairbanks and Prudhoe Bay. And I've lived here before the road was built. My family's lived in the Central Brooks Range. We've worked long and hard for sustainability with these game resources. And so I'm very concerned as an Alaskan resident that we're reallocating our resource to non-residents and not actually doing what this bill is proposed to do.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll have one more, Nicole Justine, Justin Fliss.
Yeah, hi, this is Nicole Fliss. I'm in Fairbanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
So I am a property owner in Weissman, which, as you just heard, is a small village within the Dalton Highway corridor in the Brooks Range. But my primary residence is here in Fairbanks. I hunt doll sheep and caribou all outside the corridor by foot and by dog team. There is absolutely no need to change the law as it is currently written, prohibiting off-road vehicles on the land in the corridor. Only the lazy and uninspired would claim the current law denies their access to the public lands along the Dalton. As members of the Transportation Committee, you must consider not only the overwhelming evidence that this bill will threaten the sensitive wildlife and subsistence uses along the corridor, but you must also consider the following. First, allowing snow machines in the corridor will cost money. It will cost money in the increased demand for emergency services, increased need for public safety, and increased need for fish and wildlife protection. Second, allowing snow machines in the corridor will increase accidents on and off the highway. It will increase medical emergencies. It will increase search and rescue needs. It will increase the chance for trespassing violations on private lands. It will increase the chance for vandalism of mining equipment, including their explosives. It will increase the chance of vandalism on private property of local Alaskans, private property of local tourism operations, private property of Alyeska, and the University of Alaska Research Facilities, all located within the corridor, all susceptible to this increased risk. And as you just heard, there are no emergency services in place right now. And thirdly, allowing snow machines in the corridor will require road improvements, including paving, more and larger pullouts, parking areas, outhouses, and trash receptacles. So I asked the committee, where is the fiscal note attached to this obviously costly bill? Without it, the local people, the businesses, and the miners are left insecure and unsafe. I want myself and my property protected. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nicole. Actually, there were several people on our committee that were on that highway this summer. We flew up and drove back, and we actually drove back with truckers. And so we were actually inside those great big trucks coming down. And let me tell you, in the summertime, it's not exactly a piece of cake. So in the wintertime, I can't imagine. I know that those pullouts definitely have to be there because for emergency purposes, for sure. I'm going to close our meeting today. We will continue with this on Tuesday, because I have about 22 more people that would like to testify. So there's just no way, and we will try. Hopefully, we'll be able to get started on time next time, and we will actually hear as much more testimony as we can. I can understand both sides of this, and this is definitely very controversial. And so what I think we'll do is just spend some time listening to people that have concerns, or the ones that see that this is something, an advantage for them to be able to get out and recreate and hunt and have fun. So we will continue this next week, and on Tuesday at 3 o'clock. And having said that, 1 o'clock. I'm sorry, you're right, 1 o'clock. And we will adjourn this meeting.